Well, happy birthday to half of you in here. And me as well, really. It's pretty wonderful. We have something in common. Yes, I grew up in the Baptist church too, and so I can remember as a little kid, you know, singing all these songs, and one that they taught us to sing was, I'll give you the lyrics, I won't sing it, but it's, I am determined, I've made up my mind, I'll serve the Lord. And while that's what they were singing, what I was singing was, I am a turnip. I've made up my mind, I'll serve the Lord. And so I was good with that for quite a few years when somebody finally corrected me and said, you know, that's not what the rest of us are singing. But it didn't matter. I was pretty joyous while I was singing, and that's what I really got out of it. The words could have been anything, really, so I was just happy to be able to sing. So I have to say that most people have a misconception about Buddhism. Probably not you, but most people do. They think it's a religion. It's not. It was never meant to be a religion. It was meant to be probably the first self-help manual that anyone ever had. And so what happened was this guy, I'll tell you a quick version of the story. This guy was rich. He had everything. He was handsome. He had a beautiful wife. His father was sort of like a king. He got everything he wanted, and he was fine until the day he was out going for a chariot ride with his driver, and he saw an old woman all bent over and sitting on the ground, and he said to his driver, "What's wrong with her?" And he said, "Oh, you know, master, she's crippled. She's been like that for all her life, and so she's not able to walk. She's there, and she's hoping that people will give her something, you know, to help her live." It just struck a blow to this guy. His name was Siddhartha Gautama. And so Siddhartha just couldn't believe that that had happened to somebody, because everybody around him was in pretty good shape, and, you know, they were all wealthy, all of the people he came across, except for maybe some of the servants in their residence. So he was really disturbed by that. The second thing that happened to him was he had been protected from the fact that people die. Now, how could somebody be in their 20s and not know that? He was in his 20s and he did not know that. So one of his little journeys out with his driver in the chariot, they were going by a funeral of sorts. They were cremating somebody at the charnel grounds. And so he said, "Well, what's going on there? What's happening?" And this driver, who evidently was responsible for a big part of his education, because he didn't know these things, it's hard to believe, but he said, "They died. And so when they died, they do two things. If they are of a higher caste, then they get cremated. And if they're not, then they're put on a little elevated platform and let the birds eat them." He was horrified. He couldn't believe that people would die. He couldn't believe that he would die. So he asked the chariot driver, "Will that happen to me? Will I die?" And he said, "Yes, sir, we all die." And so he said, he took that information and he said, "I don't understand this at all. Why are we living if we're just going to die? Why are we here when it just comes to an end? And if it comes to an end, what happens to us then? What becomes of us?" So he decided that he was going to find out the answer to these questions. And in order to do that, he wanted to do what most people did in India at the time, who turned out to be hardcore spiritual seekers, and that was go to the woods. Go to the woods, meditate, hang with some other hippies that were out there doing the same thing, and hopefully learn something from them that you can use to feel better about the fact that, yeah, we get sick and all of us will die. Well, he learned a lot of good tricks out there in the woods with these hippies. because they taught him how to meditate, to do a specific kind of meditation. They talked about reincarnation, which was what the popular belief was in his country, based on the Hinduism, which was the majority religion in that country. Well, he wasn't ever really satisfied with that. And what they were doing, some of them, was they were really sacrificing themselves. They wouldn't eat, they wouldn't drink, they wouldn't sleep. They just sort of were going to sit there until they felt enlightened. Well, he got so skinny that, you know, you could just see his backbone looking at his belly. He didn't eat anything. And he realized, why am I doing this if I'm not really getting knowledge? Why am I doing this? He realized he had become really extreme in his seeking this to his own detriment. And so as he was thinking about all that, a young woman came up, a girl, and she brought him a bowl of rice. And she said, here, please take this as an offering. I don't have anything else. And so he kind of felt like that was a significant thing, that maybe this was something he should really pay attention to. Why would he kill himself, you know, in order to find answers to questions that were really unsolvable? So he took the rice and he ate it, and that's what broke his fast of probably about 3 months of not eating. He did drink water. But what would happen to us if we didn't eat for 3 months? So he said, this is just not the way at all. It's something else. There's something else that I need to do to find out the mystery to this. And so he made a vow. He said, I am not getting up until I have answers. And he sat down on a little piece of woven grass that someone had given him under the Bodhi tree. And as he sat there, he sat for days and days. And he had a lot of things just kind of coming to him, the information and the questions that he had. And so at one point, he sort of had a conclusion. He said, doing what I was doing is not it. And not doing anything is not it. I have to find a middle way, a way that works, a way that keeps me healthy, a way that makes me stronger, a way that makes me be comfortable with the world as it is, even though in this world I will probably get sick and I will probably die. Well, 80 years later, actually 60 years later, because he was already 20 when he was doing this, he did indeed get sick. He had a Even though he mostly was a vegetarian, if he was visiting somebody, he ate whatever they had. He made a commitment to that. So he ended up eating a piece of foul meat, and it made him sick, and he died. But after he had his little moment of enlightenment, he said, I don't know what to do with this now that I have some answers. What do I do? How do I just, you know, live my life, or do I teach? And so, again, his cousin primarily came to him and said, you know, Siddhartha, you've really done something here. You've become a stellar person. You've perfected yourself in a way that entitles you to share this knowledge of what happened. So that's what he did. And he said, well, how do I formulate this? So the first thing he did was to state the problem. The problem is life kind of sucks sometimes. We don't like it like that. We would really like to be happy all the time because that's what we really want. He said, but that's not how the world is. So let's be real about this. Let's look at the world for what it actually is. Bad things are going to happen in your life. Some good things are going to happen in your life. Stuff will hit the fan, and yes, it'll affect you in negative ways. And if you understand that that's just how it is and don't spend the rest of your life worrying about that, you'll be happy. So that made a lot of sense. So in order for him to explain this to other people, he had to do this. He had to come up with what he called the four noble truths. I'm afraid I'm doing naughty things to your computer.
Don't worry about it.
Sorry. I didn't bring any other furniture or anything, though. I'm not going to get into that. So he came up with this. Just understand, this is the first thing of the four noble truths. Just understand that life's going to suck sometime, and there's nothing you can do about that. So all you have is to accept that and just don't fight it. You don't have to avoid it, but you don't have to fight it either. So he said, just operate on that. So it's a matter of just knowing that there are some things that cause you to complicate that. And he came up with three really big ones. One of them is, if you get a little greedy and selfish, that makes you unhappy. The other one is, if you get angry all the time and hateful, that makes you unhappy. If you have self-denial about how you really are, then you'll end up being unhappy. He said, so that's what we need to work on, is those three things that are what make us suffer. So he explained that to them. That was the second noble truth. This is what makes you unhappy, doing these things, being selfish, not caring for other people, being greedy, taking advantage of people. All of that stuff keeps you unhappy. So if you can dump some of that stuff, you'll get happier. So he said, the way to end that, and this is the third noble truth, is you have to incorporate a way into your life to see things more clearly. And so they call that an end of suffering because it ends the causes of suffering. And that is to come to the realization and not only just think about it, but you have to believe that it is so, that these things will make you unhappy. Well, day before yesterday, Andy and I went to breakfast at Hardee's, a culinary delight, as you might imagine. And so they were understaffed that day. There were only two people there. One was in the front, the other's in the back. The woman in the back is always there. She's a nice little Latina, and she always makes the best biscuits ever. And she's busy as you could imagine. And then the guy up front was just in a flurry of madness trying to take care of everybody and having people saying, well, what's the problem? Where's my food? Everything's taking so long. What's wrong with this place? You need to get some help.
I said they don't know.
And so during all of that, you know, Andy, who is maybe my favorite person, I don't know. Yeah, I think so. So Andy decides he's going to take it upon himself to do something that'll make them a little happier. So he gave $5 to the guy at the register and $5 to the little Latina woman. And you would have thought they'd won the lottery. They were so happy. That one little thing made them so happy. Well, he was walking on a cloud for the rest of the day. That little simple act that he did made three people happy, four counting me. Because I said, well, there's a big lesson in this. It was a wonderful thing. So after identifying these causes of suffering, which is, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion, when we fail to see ourselves clearly, he said, but don't worry about that because I have the cure. And that's the fourth noble truth, the cure. And it's called the Eightfold Path, or it's called the middle way of not going to extremes. So it was really neat about that. Now, he was good at avoiding traps because they'd say, oh, Siddhartha, what happens to us after I die, after we die? He said, well, let's not worry about that right now. We've got a life to live. So let's do that instead. And so some people would say, Siddhartha, what happens? Is there a God? Is there really a God? And he said, let's not worry about that. That's a question that I don't think anyone can really answer accurately. And those who try sound silly, you know. So he would always stay away from that kind of stuff. But what he said, but don't worry about that stuff, but I can help you be happier. I can help you have a happier life. And here's the recipe. And so he had these eight things. And these eight things weren't something that you do in order. You don't do this one first and you graduate and you go to level two and do that one and get your little gold star on having done so well at that that you can move to the next one. Wasn't like that at all. He said, these are things that have to grow together. These are things that you have to work on to do. And the very first one he named was having a right view. And the right view was to be able to see the problem clearly about what it is that makes us unhappy. Those things that I named, they're called the three poisons. And so if we're angry, greedy, delusional people, then we're going to be unhappy. And the people around us are going to be unhappy. So he said, you have to be able to see that clearly, to see that this really is what's causing you to be unhappy. So the thing about it is people say, well, you know, so much stuff has happened to me in my life. Oh, I was treated cruelly growing up. My family was poor. I broke my leg in 16 places and they put it back together backwards. And you can see that it's really hard for me. My life was much worse than most anybody else's. And so he said, well, you know, that's just what you think. That's what you're thinking, but that's not necessarily accurate. So he didn't say, you know, oh, you dummy, stuff happens to everybody. He said, well, you're just not quite seeing this clearly. So what he wanted him to do was to have right view about these things and see yourself clearly, to just go, oh, geez, I stole that money and I got put in jail. I'm so unlucky. Well, there's a little more to it than that. So to have a right view, and that is a reason to really follow up on all of this stuff. That right view keeps growing with the rest of it. That's not a one-time deal. You get to see more about yourself. The older you get, the more you follow these little eight guidelines. The second one was to have right intention. And so I'll give you an example. Some people do this because they think they want to be enlightened. Well, that sounds great. Who would not want to be enlightened? But if your intention is, I'm going to be nice so that I can be enlightened, you know, that's probably not going to happen. So your intention is really to become more loving, to be more compassionate, to help you not be greedy, to keep you from getting angry, to see yourself clearly when you do things to other people that aren't so nice. So you're addressing those three poisons. So the right intention is that you want to be more compassionate. You don't want to win the lotto or to become enlightened so everyone will say, oh, Kathy's enlightened. Although she may be, who am I to say? So the third one that they had was right speech. Now, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? If you're going to call people names, would you say that's right speech? Not so much. So right speech is to be able to say kind things to people and to know when to shut up when you're about to say something not kind. It's really that simple. Right speech is really putting a governor on this. So they say, okay, with right speech and also the next one, right action, the time to think about what you're going to say and how you're going to act is before you think and act, and while you're thinking and acting, and after you think and act, and that includes speaking. So they're saying, be aware, be aware, be aware of what you're about to do and what you're about to say. Well, that's about as easy as swallowing a watermelon whole. That takes a great deal of work and a great deal of self-knowledge about yourself. So after that, the next one is have a right livelihood. So the examples you always see when people talk about this is don't be a gun dealer. Don't be an executioner. Don't work in a slaughterhouse. Don't work at a company that deceives people and cheats them out of their money. So right livelihood, and this is, you know, they never do say, do this one, but don't do that one. What the suggestion is be mindful enough to see these things clearly. All this is about seeing clearly is to quit fooling ourselves and to just as get to the truth of things, you know, whatever it takes to do that. So those things, those are sort of like ethical treatment of yourself and other people. And then the last two, we've got two more to go. And these are the ones that Buddhism is noted for. And it's two types of meditation. And so there's no watering these down. They have to be just as they're described. So the first one is to learn how to be mindful of what you're doing so that you can pay attention to what you're about to say. All this kind of weaves together nicely. But to be mindful of things, mindful of the world as it actually is, and not pushing it to be something other than it is. So it's all about getting real, really. And then the other one, the last one is called right concentration. Now, these two kind of blend together in an odd way. Concentration means being focused on one thing and focusing on it for a period of time. That's why the Buddhists are always saying, oh, when you meditate, watch your breath, watch your breath. That's hard as hell. It is, because you're saying, I'm not getting anything out of this. I'm watching my breath, and gosh, and I've got to go to the grocery store, so let's watch my breath another time. You know, so what really happens is they don't really care, and I don't know who this they is I'm talking about, but maybe it's me. I don't really care. No, the thing about it is you have to learn how to concentrate on one thing. I had a yoga teacher one time, a really fantastic one, and she had us do candle gazing. And it was really an interesting thing. This is a long time ago. This is probably in 1972 or earlier. Anyway, so she said, just look at the candle for what it is. Just look at it. And don't daydream, but just look at that candle and see what it's doing, as if it's the most important thing you ever saw. And so I thought, well, okay. So we sat there and we looked, and it was the most difficult thing to do because we thought about everything but the candle. So what a lot of modern Buddhist teachers do to help people with this particular one is they kind of give them little puzzles to do. And so my personal puzzle is counting. I do watch my breath when I'm meditating, but I've got this thing going on that requires my attention, because if I don't totally focus on what I am doing during this meditation, I have to start all over. So it's like, oh, somehow that seems like a terrible thing to do. Of course it's not, because all I'm doing is counting my breaths in a certain way. And so when I daydream, it goes all to hell. You know, and I go, oh, I have to start over. And I do. So what happens when I do that? It's not that I'm getting smarter and smarter and getting enlightened. I'm exercising my brain. And the thing that happens is the length of time that your mind strays will shorten. And then after a period of time, you feel it coming on. You feel the temptation to daydream, but you don't do it. And you stay on that. And so what happens, there's a physiological little mystery that happens if you can do this. If you do that for a period of, say, 25 or 20 or 30 minutes, and you're able to focus on this one thing, there comes a calmness over your body. It just descends on you. And it's like you're feeling very peaceful. You don't zone out. It's not like you're not there anymore. In fact, you're more there than you've ever been. But you're sitting there with total awareness, and it feels so good that you get this little physiological reward for that. There are hundreds and maybe more ways to do that kind of thing. The little counting thing, and if you want to know what it is afterwards, I'll tell you. It's really simple. But for some people, it's a mantra. If you're doing the same mantra and you focus on what the words mean, if you're just saying the mantra and not really thinking of that, but are you going to be late to school or whatever it is? But no, you have to concentrate on that mantra and what it means. So if you can do that for a period of 20 minutes, you get the same effect. A kind of peace just descends on you, and you're sitting there feeling like everything is right with the world. So you got two things going on here. One is you need to kind of do an inventory of your naughty business when you've been greedy, angry, selfish. When you delude yourself and kind of think a little more of yourself than you probably should. I should say I, but we all do that. So you got that going on. And to the degree that you can dismantle those bad character defects, if you want to call them that, what happens is it leaves a void, and you know what comes in instead? Compassion. You become filled with kind of a love for people. And you know what? When you do, you get so happy. Just the fact that you could give $5 to somebody at a restaurant. But you have to have your mind, you know, overcome the fact that, I don't know, $10 is a lot of money. I don't have a lot of money. I shouldn't be doing this. You know, all that little chatter. So we have to really see ourselves clearly in order to sweep away some of the defects that we have. And we don't really just decide we're going to be compassionate, but it fills the void. It comes anyway when we do that. I have a reading that I'm going to do very quickly. If I can find it. There it is. Okay, so I'm going to read to you from this holy book. It's called Buddhism for Dudes. Yes. So it's also for dudettes. He said so in the beginning. So this guy was a Marine. After the World Trade Center was destroyed, he decided he was going to, for some reason, go to Pakistan and try to make sense of all of this for himself. As it turns out, he ended up in Sri Lanka instead. Good move on his part, I have to say, because after the World Trade Center, you know, Pakistan was just a horrible place to be if you were an American or even a Westerner. So he spent several months, actually a couple of years, in this monastery in Sri Lanka. And the word Sri means holy. I don't know if you knew that or not. It used to be Ceylon. So it's Holy Lanka, the Holy Land. And it's where the most original form of Buddhism went when it was driven out of India when the Muslims invaded in 1200. So they went to Ceylon. Some went north, some went east. But so this has turned out to be the most like the original Buddhism that there is in Sri Lanka. And so somehow they ended up with lots of holy relics. They ended up with a lot of scripture. And it was a really good thing for him because he really got it. And when he left, the monks told him, said, now you have a big obligation. You have to share this with other people, and not necessarily by what you say to them, but you have to demonstrate to them that you are doing these things, that you are happy because of this. And he says plainly, he said, I've never been happier in my life. So I'm have a little reading here. And this is what he says about right thought. Right thought is what you need to pull all this stuff together. the ability to see the world naked, then it turns you into someone who sheds selfish desire, ill will, thoughts of violence and evil, hatred and anger. And why would you do this? Because they're foolish waste of time. That's why. These thoughts and feelings are harmful and destructive to you and to others. The people who do the most of the conspicuous overconsumption, hate-mongering, and violence-generating do not do so much because they're evil, but it's because they just don't know the truth. They don't get that big deal they're making about themselves or their issues, and that doesn't amount to shinola in the long run. They lack wisdom. They suffer from ignorance. That's right, they're morons. So he threw that in there as just to be clever and funny, because he says, surprisingly, feelings of compassion, love, and magnanimity fill the vacuum where your delusions used to be. When you first get it, you might experience frustration like you don't know a secret that most other people don't, even though you wish they did. Overall, though, you feel a renewed sense of faith in humanity. Why? Because you've come to realize that there are people who have never read a word of the Dharma, who are the most peacemaking, unspoiled, guileless, generous, and beneficial people on the earth. There are swarms of wonderful people around who are basically Buddhist, and they don't even know it. Eight simple things, very, very hard to do. I wish you well on your spiritual journey. Thank you for having me today. It's always a joy to be here.